Well, good evening and welcome on this rather cold and wet evening. So we concentrate on quality here, not quantity, as you can see. So my name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies and in the college here. I'd like to welcome you and welcome our much distinguished guest speaker, whom I'll introduce in a moment. The annual lecture in Law and Society is now a regular event in the calendar. It's sponsored by the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which is based here in the college. It's an independent foundation devoted to the role of law in society, understanding the very practical role of law in society. The foundation is affiliated with the Center for Sociolegal Studies, which is a research institute to which a number of us in the room belong, and it also is dedicated to the study of law in society. But whereas it's a research institute here at the foundation, we're more committed to disseminating, to making more readily accessible and available some of the ideas floating around in the academic work. And of course, we're in Woolston College, which in this splendid new auditorium, which is less than a year old, and I do think is one of the more superior ones around where there is fierce competition. Well, on that note, I'd like now to very much greet our visiting speaker, our visiting lecturer, Professor Carlo Guarnieri from Bologna University. Carlo is no stranger to Oxford. He's been here several times before, working mainly in the Centre for Sociolegal Studies, conducting research in law and society. Carlo comes with a very distinguished academic and professional background. He's professor of Italian political system in the Faculty of Political Science at Bologna. But he has taught in many universities in the United States and in France, and has been a regular visitor to all sorts of other places around the globe. He's been Dean of the Faculty of Political Science at Bologna, and now is the head of study programs in political science. Apart from his deanship and his administrative and professional duties, he also has a very distinguished and long recognized reputation in law and society for his research on courts, courts in Italy, comparative courts, civil courts, criminal courts, and so on. And so it really is a very impressive range of research and writings, much of it in English, but also quite a lot of it in French and Italian. So, Professor Guarnieri, it's a great pleasure to welcome you. Professor Guarnieri will speak for about 45 minutes, then there will be discussion, and at a certain point we'll stop discussion and have some refreshments. So, over to you, Professor Guarnieri.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to Dennis Galligan and to the Foundation for the invitation and for the chance they give me to present my ideas about what is going on in Europe on the judicial sphere, actually. And I will speak about what's working, it's happening now in several countries of continental Europe. I left out, of course, Britain. And of course, I will try to make some kind of general remarks. And of course, I will summarize, amplify sometimes the difference between countries, and maybe giving an account of what is can be considered to be a rather important, significant transformation. And I will start from a very nice little book was published almost 50 years ago, The Civil Law Tradition by John Merriman, an American legal scholar, who was actually one of the first books I read in the 70s when I was a student. And he gave me, I think, an introduction to my judicial and legal system, the Italian. And I think it's still a very important account on what is going on in the civil law countries. Actually, John Merriman was doing research in Italy in the 60s, and I think he was teaching also at the University of Florence in 67, 68. before publishing that book. Of course, in that book, John Merriman was, giving an account, a very good account of the civil law tradition, of the judicial and legal system of continental Europe. And in his account, one of the most important principles characterizing the judicial system of those countries was a very rigid interpretation of the principle of separation of powers. This was a very important principle he was emphasizing the role in. In his view, the principle of separation of powers was defined in such a way that each branch of the state had to be entrusted with a specific function, to Parliament and only to Parliament, the task of legislating, to the government and only to the government, the execution of the law, and to courts, to the judicial system, the task of resolving conflicts arising from the application of the laws. This rigid definition was related to the efficient arrangement of the state, to the preservation of freedom and liberties, and to respect for the basic principle of democracy, popular rule. This principle required that not only that every branch should be separated one from the other, independent one of the other, but also that they perform their institutional function without interfering or being interfered by the other branches. And so Parliament had to only legislate, government had only to administer and to execute the laws, and the judiciary had only to adjudicate. In this scheme, the legislature enjoyed a prominent role by being the only institution authorized to issue general legal rules. I give you an example I take from Italy. If you take the old Italian constitution of 1848, the Statuto, and was a constitution which was not very different from other continental countries like the Belgian or the French, at the Article 73, it was proclaimed that the interpretation of the laws, when compulsory for all, is only the prerogative of legislative power. So this was the idea that, every rule, every general rule had to be entrusted only to Parliament. The executive was conceived in a literal way to execute, to carry out, and only to execute, to carry out the statutes, possibly enjoying only that amount of discretion that the legislator had thought advisable to concede. So it was a very definite definition. As for the judge, his task, and sorry I say his, because until the middle of the 20th century, all judges were males, at least in continental Europe. I think the women were admitted to the judiciary in France only in 1930, in Italy only in 1964, and so the judiciary were all males. So the task of the judge was to resolve cases only according to the legal rules laid down by the legislature. In fact, he was considered to be the operator of a machine. It was an expression used very often in the legal doctrine, built by the legislator, maybe under the advice of the expert, the legal scientists, the law professors. Actually, the law professors were very important in this scheme because the role of the legal scholars was very important. In fact, they had to influence, in a very, pervasive way the way the legislature was working. For example, because they were very often member of parliament, or if they were not member of parliament, they were working in advisory commission in the parliament or in the government. So the role of the legal scholar in this scheme was extremely important. And the role of the judge, moreover, was further narrowed by the fact that the state tended to become the unique source of law, because the legal atmosphere was very much pervaded by legal positivism. All extra status source of law was considered minor, or anyway was to be considered with a very, very, very much care. The division of labor envisaged by this interpretation of the principle of the separation of powers was considered, and still can be, in some way rather efficient. I explain myself what I mean by that. In fact, in this way, the political sterilization of the judge was achieved without much effort. Judges were separated and protected from politics, from government. So it was a significant result, since it implied the democratic legitimacy of independent judges. The judge were considered, I think, the best definition of this conception is still that phrase very much, very often quoted by the Baron de Montesquieu, who was anyway a judge, as you know, was a judge in Bordeaux, and he said that the judge had to be, you know, la bouche qui prononce les paroles de la loi, the mouth pronouncing the word of the law. And but I think what is more interesting is the other, you know, the conception, des êtres inanimés, lifeless being. You know, the judge had to be really a machine, someone without life. This, although reality could be different, actually, judicial creativity was hidden from view, or in any case considered to be marginal. This setting was also efficient from an organizational point of view. The judge had only to resolve conflicts, more often than not by evaluating the effect of the case, and then to apply the law to them. You know, the function of law of legal interpretation, you know, dire le droit, juris dicere, could be performed without much difficulty, at least if the legislator and the academic doctrine have done their job very well. Of course, sometimes there were problems. Sometimes it could happen that some statute was not well drafted, or some new unforeseen case would arise not well covered by the legislation. In these cases, the judge had only to rely on the well-set tools of legal interpretation provided for by the academic doctrine. It was therefore not too difficult from the good judge to find out the right answer to the case. No? If the right answer to the case was not found by the judge, it meant that the judge was not a good judge. So if you read, for example, the evaluation of judges made by the Court of Cassation until the middle of the 20th century, you will find that, you know, the good judge was able to find out the right answer, and the right answer was those, you know, point at by the Court of Cassation. So there was always a right answer. The right answer was what the higher judges, the judge of the Cassation, the Supreme Court, was thinking of. As for the administration of courts, it was entrusted mainly to the Ministry of Justice. Often in the Ministry of Justice, the staff was made by high-ranking judges on more or less temporary leave from their position. For instance, in France, they were, and still are to some extent, high-ranking members of the prosecutorial corps. But I think to remind you that in France, in Italy, and in many, several countries of Europe, prosecutors and judges belong to the same organization. They are magistrates, I could say. So they can switch their position without much difficulty. And so, and if you think, there is a good example of that. There is a very nice book published in 1930 by a British scholar, Robert Ensor. It's one of the first analyses of the setting of courts in continental Europe. In the chapter of France, there are some biographical data about higher-ranking judges. It is very interesting to see that all these higher-ranking judges had spent a part of their career in the Ministry of Justice, in the prosecution, and they end up in the Court of Cassation. This was more or less the pattern. Anyway, so significant political decisions were taken in the ministry, for instance, where to allocate resources, which judges to promote, often in a very cozy relationship between senior judges and politicians. However, this arrangement, notwithstanding its relative efficiency, became the object of increasing criticism. It allowed too much influence to the executive over judges, and above all, it was not really able to protect citizen rights from legislative encroachments, as the rise of dictatorships in the period between the two world wars was tragically demonstrated. So the tragic experiences of the first half of the 20th century had a deep impact on the political system, of course, especially in continental Europe. The authoritarian and totalitarian solution, however, have been progressively discredited, and democracy has been increasingly perceived as the only game in town. Since the end, as many of you know, since the end of the Second World War, waves of democratization, we speak about waves of democratization, have followed. First, Austria, Germany, and Italy. Later, the countries of Southern Europe in the 1970s, and the countries of Central and Eastern Europe in the 90s. However, the memories of the past, of the crisis of the Italian and German democracies, of the rise of authoritarianism in the Iberian Peninsula, or the advent of communist regime, all these memories have support an interpretation of democracy emphasizing the significance of its constitutional dimension, understood as providing a set of limits to exercise of power, especially political, governmental and legislative power. Thus, the power to be protected has become to be identified not only with the executive, but also with the legislature, with politics more and more considered as being the potential source, if not of tyranny, of abuse. Therefore, the democracy of the second part of the 20th century have devoted a lot of effort to reinforce citizen guarantees toward the political branches. The political branches have become the target of, you know, this constitutional design. So it is well known that one of the consequences of this movement has been the introduction in the constitution of many, almost all, continental European countries of extensive catalogues of rights and, above all, the institution of forms of judicial review of legislation, constitutional review. The significance of these changes has been already and rightly emphasized. It is enough here to say that in this way some of the traditional myths of the civil law tradition have been dismantled. For instance, the omnipotence of the legislature, whose decisions are now under the judgment of a court, while the long list of constitutional rights, often worded in a rather vague language, have weakened the traditional legal positivism. However, the significance of constitutional review has been extensively considered. It's not new, of course. The same cannot be said of another important change: judicial independence. The justification of judicial independence in a constitutional state is rather clear. If disputes have to be solved by the impartial third, its independence from the parties have to be ensured. Since directly or indirectly, the political branches are often part of the dispute, for instance, as a public prosecutor, or when the constitution of a state is under discussion, the judge must be protected from the pressure of not just the executive, but also the legislature. Therefore, the drive to reinforce citizen guarantee had also to consider the role of the judges and the need to reinforce their independence. In this way, in the second part of the 20th century, the status of the judges has been increasingly protected from political pressure. The traditional power of continental European governments to appoint at least the top of the judicial pyramid has been more and more circumscribed. For instance, today, in a significant number of civilian countries, all decisions affecting judges are taken by a collegial body, the Judicial Council, the Higher Council, something with different names, in which the executive plays only a minor part and sometimes no part at all, since in varying proportion its members are judges elected by their colleagues or lawyers appointed by the legislature. Moreover, a recent trend has been the development of a new dimension of judicial independence, the so-called internal independence, refer to the relationship between judges, higher judges, and lower ranking judges. So this has been a rather recent development, which is very important and taking place in several countries. So the traditional powers of the judicial hierarchy, over judicial careers, over judicial promotion, has been reduced. At the same time, judicial training, initial training of in-service training, has become an important part of the process of professional socialization of the judges. Training which is often entrusted to specialized institutions managed mainly by judges. In this institution, young judges can develop important horizontal relationships. In this way, overcoming the traditional artisan-like vertical setting which older and higher ranking judges were tutoring younger colleagues. So, the result of all this change has been that judges, civil law judges, have seen their institutional independence very much reinforced. The announcement of judicial independence has had a significant impact on the organization of the judicial organization of the civil law countries. We have seen that traditionally the administration of justice, the organization of courts, was the domain of the executive. The prerogatives of the executive in this field are still large, but the growing independence of judges has supported an expansion of the role also in this domain. In addition, the increasing inflow of cases have put under pressure the administration of justice in several countries, emphasizing the need of improving the efficiency of courts. In turn, the role of management has become more important, in fact supported also by fashionable approaches like the new public management applied to the judicial system. So, besides the increasing role of the National Judicial Council we have already spoken about, local judicial bodies, much more than the ministerial bureaucrats, have come to play a significant role in the administration of justice. Also because the performance of the judicial system is assessed first of all at the local level. You know, for instance, according to the percentage of cases disposed of in the first instance court. Moreover, training in judicial administration in the way judges have to deal with this situation, with the organization, is more and more often organized in those specialized institutions we have just spoke about. You know, the best example is the French École Nationale de la Magistrature, which is managed actually by the judges themselves. You know, the overall result of this trend has been an additional expansion of the autonomous role of judges. For instance, and recently an influential Dutch institution was encouraging judges to take full responsibility for the performance of courts, developing prototypes and continuously improving the procedure in a series of versions. Rules are not used as prescription how to do it, but as enablers, as point to depart. But what is happening today in France is maybe even more significant thanks to the prominence of this country in the civil law world, the influence of France and of French judicial institutions around the civil law countries is rather strong. You know, just in the recent year, the Ministry of Justice, after an extensive analysis of the state of the judicial system, of the French judicial system, is developing a project, La Justice du XXe siècle, the justice in the 21st century, envisaging a series of reform and above all, emphasizing the need for the judge to take a new and much more active role in judicial organization. The result of this trend has been well summarized recently. You know, in this way, the historical developed state practice, according to which a large number of competences concerning court management was allocated to the legislature and above all to the executive power, today has to be reevaluated in favor of the possibility of judicial self-management. Just to summarize, we can say that judicial self-management and judicial self-government, which is judicial independence, are becoming the distinctive traits of the judicial law, of the civil law judicial organization. I may add that all these developments have been strongly supported by the emergence and expansion of a supranational and transnational judicial dimension. I explain what I mean by that. You know, the influence on national courts by supranational judicial institutions like the European Court of Justice and the European Court of Human Rights is well known. This is something I think has been very well analyzed, and I am not going to speak about that. I may add that also the reinforcement of judicial independence has been supported both at both levels. Here, the role of the Council of Europe has been very important. In 2010, the Council of Europe has issued a recommendation on judicial independence, detailing all the requirements for a country to be recognized as respecting judicial independence. It's a very important document in which, you know, all the changes or in the status of judges have been analyzed. Moreover, we can also have to consider the role played by the Venice Commission in its assessment of the situation of different states, and by the several networks of judges. There are at least two formal networks of judges at the Council of Europe level: the judges network and the prosecutor network. You know, they have a French acronym: the Conseil Consultatif des Juges Européens, a Conseil Consultatif of European prosecutors. And they are very active by just supporting initiative and make recommendation about the changes to be introduced in these countries. Also in the field of judicial administration, the role of the Council has become very significant. We have the CEPEJ, which is the European Commission for the Efficiency of Justice. It's a body composed mainly of judges. And has become a very important reform actor, gathering data about the functioning of national judicial systems and supporting different organizational reform. Recently, the CEPEJ has become the basis for the policies of the European Union. So from the Council of Europe level, we are now going to the European Union level. And the European Union, the Commissioner for Justice, has introduced the so-called EU Judicial Scoreboard, you know, in order to assess the process of change of European judicial system. And this scoreboard is based on the data provided by the CEPEJ, by the Council of Europe. Finally, we don't have to forget the pressure in support of reform, especially those strengthening judicial independence, exerted by judicial association, also at the European level. There are several national judicial associations, pushing for reform, but there are also some important, you know, European or international associations. There is an International Association of Judges with the European branch, and there are some very active group we are going back on that later, on a very political profile, like the association named MEDEL. It's a Magistrate Européen pour la Démocratie et la Liberté, European Magistrate for Democracy and Justice. It's a kind of transnational judicial association grouping 18 national groups. So it's very active in the field of judicial reform. Of course, all these changes, what is the consequences of all these changes we have summarized very, very in a short way here? All these institutional reforms have had an obvious impact on the judges and their role in the legal and political system of the countries of continental Europe. Briefly said, the outcome has been the emergence of judges much more active and also much more powerful than in the past two centuries. You know, it's a fact actually that Merriman himself was noticing in the second and third edition of the book. He published three editions and already in the second say, oh well, my description is changing because judges are becoming much more active than once. You know, but there is some interesting development here. Not only constitutional review have been introduced in most continental countries, but its practice is not any longer contained in specialized constitutional courts. It has percolated into the world judicial court. In fact, as a rule, ordinary courts have to make a first appraisal of the constitutionality of the statute in order to decide whether or not to ask the constitutional court for a decision. The incidental procedure, this is happening always. In this way, ordinary judges have become too accustomed to critically evaluating the legislation. They look to the law, to the statutory law, to the legislative law, in a way much different from the past. In the past, the statutory law was the law. Now it's something we have to confront with the Constitution, with the fundamental rights you find in the Constitution. Very often, sometimes, constitutional courts have also invited ordinary judges to interpret existing statutes in such a way to make them compatible with the Constitution, even without an intervention by the Constitutional Court, and with the consequence that judicial lawmaking has been justified formally. In addition, the insertion of national courts in the system of supranational justice we already, talk about, the European Court of Justice and the European Court of Human Rights, has further expanded the complexity of the legal and judicial systems, with obvious consequences for judicial creativity. There is recently has been this state of the legal system has been summarized by saying that the judge now is working in a labyrinth of legal norms. It's inside the labyrinth, and she must struggle a lot in order to find the way out, the right decision, because it's really very complicated to identify, the real meaning of the legal system in a specific case. Moreover, the increase of internal independence has made judges much more autonomous from the traditional influence of national supreme courts. Once the career of lower court judges was very much influenced by the Supreme Court judges. Today is not any longer so easy. Lower court judges have some independence, some autonomy, and so they can, very often, they can decide in a much more freer way than in the past. We should also remember that in most civil law countries, the function and trust to a Supreme Court in a common law countries are divided among at least three courts. A constitutional court, a supreme ordinary court, like the Court of Cassation, and a supreme administrative court, like the Conseil d'État, or at least sometimes even more, often in strong competition with each other. And if you take into account also the role of the two European courts, the concrete judicial system of several civil law countries appears to be managed by no less than five high courts. So you understand the complexity of the system in comparison with the past. The outcome of these changes has been a significant expansion of judicial creativity and of the complexity of the European judicial system. The centralized Kelsen-like system of constitutional review introduced after the war has come out seriously weakened. In continental shambles, as has been argued recently by an American scholar, Martin Shapiro, with a very, strong expression. At the general level, the stronger guarantees of judicial independence have released the judge from the constraints of the judicial and the ministerial hierarchy. The judge has been liberator. This has been a very well put by a Belgian constitutional judge. He has spoke about the la libération du juge. The judge has been liberated by all these constraints. The new status of independence did not take long to translate itself into a more activist definition of the judicial role and into the means of the traditional deference from the political and administrative authorities, whether because of the weakness of politics or out of the desire to increase their popularity. Today, continental judges, and more often also public prosecutors, are making full use of their independence and powers. The end of the immunities has been the result, in criminal justice at least. For instance, criminal investigations have begun to target the political class, the senior civil service, the top executives of private and public companies, and conviction have often followed. Of course, Italy, from this point of view, is maybe the best example, but France is not so far away, and Spain also. Belgium, you can find a lot of examples from this point of view. At the same time, the need for court, that courts enforce with vigor socio-economic rights has been emphasized increasingly by a group of progressive judges, like those belonging to the MEDEL, to the network we mentioned before of the Magistrat for Democracy and Liberty. And it's interesting to see how these groups tend to define the role of the judge. We have an interesting recent document by the MEDEL group. It's the Manifesto on Justice in Front of the Economic Crisis, which was published 2 years ago. It's the Villa Mura Manifesto was meeting there. There are several interesting statements, for example, that no economic freedom or competition rule should take priority over fundamental social rights and social progress. In case of dispute, the fundamental social rights should prevail. So I think it's very interesting to see that, you know, this is very how far from the traditional view of the civil law judge, just bound to apply the law, the statutory law. Now you have to look to fundamental social rights, and they should prevail in a situation of contradiction, of tension with statutory law. You know, but the new judges have expanded their role beyond the function of adjudicating. As we have seen, they are increasingly playing a major role in managing courts. Also in Europe, therefore, we can speak today of managerial judges. Today, judges are required to be able to take into account the multiple relationship between the judicial system and its social and political environment. I quote always by the French initiative, reform initiative. One of the judges involved in the reform just has remarked that courts must anticipate the internal and external changes they will inevitably have to confront. Justice must anticipate the evolution of this mission. Actually, this was one of the chief of the commission by the ministry in which, you know, the new role of the judge was being envisaged. You know, it's the justice must anticipate. And so you have a proactive definition, not just of the judge, but all the judicial organization. Of course, as I told you at the beginning of the speech, just to, you know, save myself from objection, you know, the analysis I have presented here is summarizing some general trends, and additional research is certainly due. In fact, significant differences exist between among the civil law countries. The trends I have presented here are mostly typical of the Latin part of Europe, France, Italy, and Spain, being the likely the best examples. On the other hand, the countries of Northern Europe, Sweden, for example, seem to be far away from these developments. Germany can be put somewhere in between, while its constitutional court has acquired a significant political prominence, and not only in Germany, think of the impact of, you know, the decision on the Euro saga still going on, you know, the impact of the decision by the Constitutional Court of Germany, but ordinary courts seem more cautious, still attached to the traditional self-restraint of the civil law judge. As for the new democracy of Central and Eastern Europe, all belonging to a different extent to the civil law tradition, this situation is still in flux, but several of them participate to a varying extent to the trend present here. For instance, Hungary, Poland, but also Romania and Bulgaria, at least from what I'm able to get. Also, Latin American courts have shown in recent decades a new disposition toward increasing creativity and assertiveness, although the variation inside the continent are still huge. But some supreme courts in Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, and Mexico, and we are talking maybe also in Chile, I think this is something, for instance, seem taking the lead in having a different, more active definition of the judicial role. However, although not homogeneous, the trend, at least in Europe, is rather clear. Therefore, can we conclude that on the whole, the civil law judge has become more similar to her common law Breton? More specifically, to what extent are the continental activist judges we have depicted here, similar to their American colleagues, because of course we are talking about US when we talk about activist judges. You know, although some similarities exist, and we, as we have emphasized, judicial creativity and political assertiveness are today frequent also in the civil law world, some deep differences still remain. The civil law judge, at least the ordinary judge, working in lower and intermediate courts, tends still to be recruited early, just after university studies. She, now we say she because most French judges today are women, 40% of Italian judges are women, 1/3 of German judges are maybe more or less are women, and you know the rate, it's increasing. I think the recent competition in Italy, I've always seen a strong majority between 55 and 60% to 65% of women. I think in France it's even more diverse. So we are talking, she continues, the judge has become female to some extent. She continues to exhibit a prevailing formal legal training and above all a lack of previous social and political experiences. Her professional relationships are prevalently aimed at other state professions in a context still marked by the so-called Balkanization of legal profession. This was another Merriman expression. The fact that the legal profession in continental Europe was divided between different branches. And so there was very few interchanges between the bar, you know, the legal practice and the judiciary, for example. In other words, the civil law judge is still, above all, a sort of special civil servant, protected by strong guarantees, but not so far away as for professional values from the rest of the civil service. It is not by chance that many of them belong to some union. In fact, sometimes they seem to define their role maybe as a policy implementer rather than a conflict resolver, but in a situation in which they play also a strong part in defining the content of the policy. However, to know whether civil and common law judges are more or less converging is only a part of the question, maybe not the most significant. An overall assessment of the consequences of the great transformation we have described here needs an appraisal of the impact of the process of institutional reforms. More precisely, are the results achieved so far more or less in line with what was anticipated? Have the reforms improved the quality of the political systems in which they have been implemented? A clear answer, of course, is not easy, even because what we have seen, the differences between different countries. Maybe it's still too soon to see all the effects of the reforms. This can be true, at least for some countries. However, some consideration can be put forward. I will try. First of all, we must point out that also in continental Europe, the new power of judges we have described are part of a broader movement toward an increased legalization of social and political processes. Powerful judges are answering an expanding demand for justice, stimulated by a growing legal profession and legitimized by the ideology of fundamental of human rights. So this movement has been able to overcome, which is very interesting, the traditional distrust for judges, for judicial power, which are very strong, especially in some countries like France, for example, a distrust which was, you know, traditional at least since the French Revolution. So this movement has been able to overcome this distrust, at least after a battle, of course, very likely by profiting from the growing fragmentation of political power, as well from the relative decline in popular support for the political branches. You know, opinion polls are, you know, results have always to be taken with care. But, you know, if you look to the very famous Eurobarometer in the last 20 years, you can see that with the exception of Sweden, in all continental European countries, you know, the justice enjoy much more support than the executive of the legislature. In the recent years, this gap has increased to some extent, at least in some countries. So from this point of view, the results are rather clear. We should add that the impact of this transformation on European political system seem positive. So far, all data available point toward a general improvement of freedom, not only in Western Europe, but also in the new democracies of Central and Eastern Europe. In fact, according to the most recent assessment by Freedom House, you take a very well-known assessment, all 28 EU countries are classified as free, completely free, with usually very high score. You know, the score range from 1 the best to 7 the worst. And so the European countries have always 1 or 2, no less than 2, on both political rights and civil liberties dimension. So they are very good scores from this point of view. So although in this process it's not easy to disentangle the role of courts from other social and political factors, it seems that the overall quality of European continental democracy has much improved in the last half century. However, the so-called mighty problem raised many years ago by an Italian scholar, by Mauro Cappelletti, who was professor of civil procedure in Florence and Stanford, and actually in a book published by Oxford University Press, if I remember well, the mighty problem remains unsolved, and the developments we have considered here have made it maybe worse. How to justify independent and powerful judges, especially when, as in continental Europe, they form an organized group, often with a strong esprit de corps enjoying some form of self-government, in a democracy, at least as democracy has been understood the last two centuries, as implying some form of popular rule. We don't need to revisit all the extensive debate here. You know, it's an enormous debate. The fact is that there is no clear and definite answer to the question. Usually, always Martin Shapiro has pointed out, you know, scholars tend to agree that some form of judicial power is necessary for democracy, but not too much, and then conduct a never-ending argument about how much is too much. So it's not easy. However, the emergence of judicial power in continental Europe shows some specific traits, not always taken full account by court supporters. In fact, judicial power in Europe, and something I have already mentioned that, but I want to emphasize, is represented not only by a small group of constitutional or Supreme Court judges, often appointed by the political branches, but by a large number of career civil service judges recruited only on the basis of a technical legal competence, and often without any significant professional experience. These judges are producing what has been recently labeled as the concrete jurisprudence, the concrete cases, not always passively reproducing the rulings of the Supreme Courts. So this is an effect, I think, which needs to be taken into account when we discuss the problem. Anyway, the specific traits of the Continental Judicial Corps are highly significant also for a recent debate on the respective qualities of the American and European legal system. A very important debate which has been coming out in the last 15 or 20 years. Actually, in the 90s, I think it was Robert Kagan who introduced the concept of adversarial legalism as a way of analyzing the workings of the American legal and administrative system. Robert Kagan was critical of the American setting, pointing at its more costly form of legal consultation, more fragmented decision-making processes, more legal uncertainty, and emphasizing the strong role played by courts in this development. Instead, Robert Kagan considered much more efficient the European settings and argued that, in any case, it was difficult for adversarial legalism to spread to Europe. Different political and legal cultures, stronger bureaucratic legalism, stronger political parties and bureaucracies made unlikely an easy transplantation. However, some years later, another scholar, Daniel Kellerman, we know well, he was here often, I think, replied introducing the concept of Eurolegalism. Actually, Kellerman was arguing the policies of economic liberalization and the increasing role of European institutions, characterized by a higher level of fragmentation, together with a new role of courts, supported in turn by a fundamental rights regime, you know, a regime in which fundamental rights are playing a very important role. All these elements were pushing toward forms of legal decision making similar, not identical, but similar to adversarial legalism, and were characterized by a stronger role for courts. Kellerman was arguing that the overall impact of these changes has been positive, especially greater transparency and accountability of state governments and of the European Union itself, and greater opportunities for access to justice have been achieved. It is difficult to adjudicate in a definite way. Both authors have significant arguments in support of their thesis. Without doubt, we have seen that in the recent decades have been characterized, also in continental Europe, by a stronger role of courts. However, both authors seem to assume that judicial activists will be confined to European or at most national high court. But as we have seen, there is evidence that the process of judicialization is involving more or less also lower courts. In any case, lower courts play a crucial role because they feed cases to constitutional courts and they make pressure on those courts. For example, you have a very recent example. Just a couple of months ago, the Italian constitutional courts declared the electoral law unconstitutional. And the decision was a very bold decision, and it was made under the pressure of several requests by lower courts to declare at least some of the law unconstitutional. Actually, I think also the German constitutional court, as a couple of years ago, declared the European electoral law in part unconstitutional. And similar cases are still to be decided also in Italy and somewhere. So the lower courts also make this kind of pressure on constitutional court by asking for decision and sending cases. So which consequences will this development entail? It's not clear at all. Anyway, for a long while, national courts have enjoyed a higher level of trust than the political branches, and this state of things does not seem to have changed, as I told you. So the Euro pessimism recently prevailing among public opinion, much less among lawyers, we say, is mainly due to the effects of the economic crisis and to the austerity policies. This Euro pessimism seems to have affected mainly the political branches. However, public opinion seems sometimes to become less happy about the way the judicial process is working, especially in those countries in which judicial independence has been most strengthened. For instance, trust in justice tends to be lower in countries having introduced powerful judicial council in order to attain some sort of judicial self-government. Moreover, the role of courts has come under severe and maybe unfounded criticism in several Eastern Central European states where judicial power was initially welcome. Hungary, it's very complicated, the situation in Hungary, you know, but also in Romania and Bulgaria, for example. We will see whether these phenomena are temporary or will remain confined to relatively new consolidating democracy or will spread across the rest of the continent. Anyway, even without considering the counter-majoritarian argument, some doubts can be raised about the capacity of continental judges to fill the new engaging task we have seen they are going to perform. Have they the necessary political and social skills? Are the constitutional Supreme Court judges, a large part of them exhibiting only legalistic competence, able to successfully confront the so-called Melbury moments? What is a Melbury moment? I found this definition very, very interesting. It's a Melbury moment is when a high court asserts a new power, but does so in a subtle or strategic way that makes hard for politicians to reject it. So it's a moment in which the political skills of the judge must be very high, very strong. Will they be able not to let their own claims to power become a political issue and instead to exploit divisions among politicians. And again, are the new training schemes instituted in several countries capable to fill the gap between ordinary judges still recruited mainly through procedures designed for traditional judges and civil servants, whose task is simply to apply the law without creativity, and a role already demanding also a much more complex array of skills, lato sensu, political and social skills. No clear answer can still be done. It can happen that at the end, the new judges will result as a welcome and fruitful addition to the political systems of continental Europe. But before that, some caution is necessary. What can be said, only can be said today, is that deep changes have affected the civil law judges. To the already considered power of constitutional review, large doses of self-government and self-management have been added. But they still remain radically different from the common law. Right. Thank you.